Today on the Grave Talks, a conversation about the history and hauntings at Fort Mifflin with Beth Beattie, Executive Director. Fort Mifflin in Philadelphia is a National Historic Landmark. It is one of the only intact Revolutionary War battlefields and the only fort in Philadelphia. It was commissioned in 1771, and in the fall of 1777, it was bombarded and captured by the British. Hundreds of soldiers were killed or wounded during the brutal attack. In a visit to Fort Mifflin, you would not only stand on a Revolutionary War battlefield, but you would also be inside a Civil War prison and next to a magazine storing gunpowder during World War II. With a rich history like that, it's no surprise that Fort Mifflin is also quite haunted. In fact, it's widely regarded as one of the most haunted sites in America. Many spirits haunt its grounds, including the Faceless Man and the Screaming Lady. I'm Carol Hughes, and on this episode of The Grave Talks, we'll talk about the history and the hauntings of Fort Mifflin with Beth Beattie. Beth, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really, really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
This is going to be a very interesting conversation. Because when you think back on the history of Fort Mifflin, it goes way back.
It's older than our country.
When they say that it was originally commissioned in 1771
is sort of still in the aftermath of the French and Indian War. And there was still piracy even on the Delaware River. So the British were very concerned with defending their wealthy colonial city of Philadelphia, which is one of the wealthiest cities in the world at that time. They were looking for a place to, south of the city from which to defend any river access to the port of Philadelphia. They commissioned John Montressor, who was the British chief engineer in America, to fortify Mud Island, which, as you can imagine, is not a great place to build anything, let alone a military fortification. And they give him a limited budget, and he sets to work. And he runs out of money well before he finishes his project, sends back to the king and requests additional funding. And his request was declined. So he tells the king, as your grant is contracted, so must be your works. And he departs, leaving the fort unfinished. So this is sort of how it stayed until about 1775. At this point, the seeds of the American Revolution are taking root, and Benjamin Franklin convenes the Committee of Safety in Philadelphia, and they recognize the strategic location of this partially completed fort on Mud Island. Because we're just south of the confluence of the Schuylkill and the Delaware. And from this vantage point, you can defend both the front door access to the city up the Delaware River and the back door access up the Schuylkill River. And remember that in the 18th century, you're not just motoring a bunch of boats wherever you want to go. They're under sail, so they have to tack. And the Delaware River is narrow and shallow. So this spot on Mud Island, which is right near the shipping channel, is a great place to do this. They garrison the fort in 1775, begin to make some meager improvements, and by 1777, the fort is pressed into service.
It sounds like building something on an island called Mud Island would have been very difficult even in today's time, but when you think about then...
One of my favorite things to tell scout groups or other visitors who are coming after a rain is that the fort was built on Mud Island and we mean it. Because even today, I can tell you that the moat is over its banks and, water is a constant challenge here at Fort Mifflin.
It's surprising that Fort Mifflin still stands.
It is. And that's one of the compelling features of a visit to the fort is that it is 100% original historic fabric. It wasn't reconstructed because it's a compelling historic site. The buildings were constructed over a timeline of service to serve a military purpose.
Can you give us an idea of the layout? How big of a area are we talking about? Is it pretty good size?
The fort property is between 40 and 50 acres. We're riverfront. It's surrounded by a moat. I want to say inside the fort are about 12 acres.
Oh, that's good sized, but not huge.
It's manageable. Yeah. It's a manageable, it's manageable to see pretty much everything you want to see in a visit of 1 to 2 hours.
So there was an actual Revolutionary War battle fought on that site. Am I correct?
That is correct. So in 1777, when the fort was pressed into service, George Washington was having a really rough go of it in the Philadelphia land campaign. He loses at Brandywine, loses again at Paoli. The British actually occupy the city of Philadelphia at the end of September 1777. It's one of the only times in history when occupying your enemy's capital does not win the war. At this point, Washington realizes he's in trouble. And he loses again, just barely, at the Battle of Germantown in the beginning of October, and he wants to achieve winter quarters up at Valley Forge. So he tells the garrison at the fort to hold to the last extremity, because the British, while they've occupied the city of Philadelphia, they've swollen the population to the point where they are consuming supplies at an alarming rate. They can't pursue Washington without being resupplied. And those supplies are coming up the Delaware River in 250 vessels of war and transport, basically the mightiest navy of the 18th century world. So Washington tells the garrison at Fort Mifflin to prevent the arrival of this fleet in Philadelphia, so to give him time to get to Valley Forge. So Fort Mifflin was supported in this endeavor by our sister fort, Fort Mercer in New Jersey, and a series of underwater obstacles sunk in the bottom of the river called Chevaux de Frise, which is basically like the sort of jack-shaped objects that you see on a battlefield, same concept, only underground. It's a large box with 2 to 4 timbers, 20 to 30 feet long, topped with an iron spike, sunk to the bottom of the river. These spikes are pointed downstream. Remember, the British Navy has many large vessels, and the concept is that they could impale a northbound vessel, probably not sinking the ship, but certainly holding it stationary long enough to be fired upon by the Pennsylvania Navy or our batteries or Fort Mercer's batteries. So this effectively stalled the British for far longer than they ever imagined. They built floating batteries. These are basically cannons on rafts. They built land batteries, cannons on the adjacent land, and they laid siege to the fort for over 5 weeks. The fort continues to hold out longer than anyone ever anticipated. But in the beginning of November 1777, Mother Nature gives the British fleet a victory in that it was 2 weeks of flooding rains, which allowed them to sail two vessels, the Vigilant and the Fury, up the back channel of the fort. And there are primary source accounts that describe Marines climbing the riggings and throwing grenades into the fort at point blank range. So beginning on November 10th, 1777, the British commenced the greatest bombardment of the American Revolution. Up to 1,000 cannonballs an hour are coming down inside the fort. And the garrison is reduced to the point of being offered an extra gill or ration of rum to any soldier who could retrieve an incoming 32-pound cannonball that could be returned to the British with the compliments of General Washington. And this continues on for 6 days until at the end of the day, November 15th, 1777, the Americans can defend the site no longer. They gather up their dead and wounded. They evacuate the site, leaving a detail of 40 young soldiers behind. They spike the last 10 working cannon and set fire to the remains of the fort before they too evacuate. But they leave the fort's flag flying. So although the fort was not only defeated, but completely destroyed, it never surrendered. And so that's why we use the tagline, "The fort that saved America."
You said 1,000 cannonballs an hour. That is, I can't even wrap my brain around that. That's just,
it's staggering.
You don't
the
even
the smell, the noise, the destruction. It would have been completely overwhelming.
So when they left the fort, the last remaining men, flag flying, and they set it on fire, did it burn the fort completely down and it was rebuilt after that?
Yes. Nothing that you see today on a visit remains from the time of the siege, with one exception, an underground powder magazine that dates to the British construction. The fort was reconstructed beginning in the late 18th century under the direction of a series of French engineers. Ultimately, Henri Tussaud completed the fort. What you see today, many of the buildings date to that, like 1797, roughly up to 1800, that time period. But it is a timeline of military architecture and construction. We have a number of early 19th century buildings, and the most recent building is 1874, the Torpedo Magazine.
So after the Revolutionary War battle that was fought there, so you can still go, you can visit, you're actually at a Revolutionary War battlefield.
That is correct.
So it went on and was in use during the Civil War as well.
And even before that, there were people who, the fort was garrisoned for the War of 1812. There were people living here during the very early 19th century during the yellow fever epidemic. It was a federal prison during the Civil War and a naval munitions depot. Oh, during the early 20th century, we've housed Marine Corps barracks, and we were even wired for anti-aircraft batteries during the early years of World War II, and back to a supply depot during the Korean conflict.
The history is just overwhelming. You know, when you think about all of the things that have happened on that one site, you know, because we talk a lot about hauntings on this show, what happened on the land before then. This had everything happen on the land.
It's a really interesting, I love to equate the fort as a brick and mortar veteran, because the fort answered yes to every call to service during that incredible three century long timeline. And a lot of service wasn't really glorious service. It was a British victory in the battle that was fought here. Mm-hmm. It was a prison. It was a supply depot. It's not like there was some great grand victory here. And yet that concept of service, of serving the country, is brought to life within the walls. Because in between these periods of service were periods of complete disregard. And we describe our location. We say, oh, we're next to the airport and in the middle of nowhere all at the same time. It really is a strangely remote location. Would have been even more remote and out of the way before the surrounding area was built up, the airport, UPS, all of our industrial neighbors here. So while we have a pretty good idea of what happened during periods of occupation and military use, there are periods in between these dates of service where it was just a dark and muddy place that no one was really minding. So we don't know what might have happened here during those times.
That was going to be something I wanted to ask you about, if it ever did fall into disrepair. Because so many places, historic places like that, at some point, people didn't ever think about the future significance of such a historical place. They let the walls collapse. It falls into disrepair, and nobody ever does step up. I'm grateful that people have stepped up to save this historic fort.
Yeah, I mean, we have abundant restoration needs. The site is very, very complex. And I don't mean to throw a historic house museum under the bus here, but a historic house museum is one building on one piece of property. Maybe you have 10 rooms if you're lucky and it's a big place. We have over a dozen buildings on a site that floods regularly. So it is a very complicated environment, which leads to, you know, one thing after another, as far as just keeping ahead of the worst of the decay.
Yeah, because with the flooding, that has to be a lot to keep up with that.
The fort's surrounded by a moat, which has a point of relationship to the Delaware River, which is not functioning at 100%, you know, and hasn't been for years. And this is one of our primary restoration initiatives. The water level in the river, based on my observation, okay, this is my personal observation, not a scientific study, but I can say that the river behaves differently now than it did, say, 5 years ago. There's changing tidal patterns. There's a general elevation of the river, more likely to flood following storms, more debris in the river. So it's a concerning challenge.
With any kind of flooding, you're really fighting to keep those buildings standing, I would think, all the time.
Right, right. And keeping your feet dry.
Exactly, which as executive director has to be hard on a number of ways. And you've been there for 12 years?
Yes.
Now, is historical sites like this just something you were interested in?
I have a very sort of meandering pathway to get here. I was an accountant in my early career. Worked for, at that time, what was one of the Big Eight accounting firms. Left was home with my kids for a while, and I got involved in historic site programming at a local historic site near my home. Began working in the education program. One thing leads to another. Ended up in the office. And from there, I also started a small consulting firm with basically helping conservation easement holding organizations with their transaction reportings and recordings. And then got this job here. So it's kind of one thing leads to another.
Before you started there, have you been in your own life someone open to the paranormal or more skeptical?
I would say I'm definitely open to it. I firmly believe my previous site was probably haunted. I definitely felt a presence there, although I never saw anything. I felt, I very strongly felt a presence. Here is the in the process of getting this job. I looked into it. I'm like, oh, wow. So I made it my policy from day one to be on good terms with the living and the dead here. And I have come to learn a lot about paranormal activity, about how you can and shouldn't engage with it. And I can tell you that I am not particularly sensitive. But what makes my experience is so compelling is that I am not sensitive, and yet I have had a number of very compelling experiences here. I remain very interested in it, but it is not something, like, I do not go on investigations, like an all-night thing. I've participated in a few, but this is not my hobby.
Was it kind of obvious to you that there was more going on at the fort than literally meets the eye?
My first experience was my first day of work.
Really?
Yes. It was really, and it was a very compelling one too. I had gone out to lunch with basically sort of my liaison with the board. And it turns out she had worked at the fort earlier on in her career, maybe 10 years prior to that. And she's not someone that you would say gives you the impression that she's in, a believer in this stuff. But I had to ask if she had any experiences. And she says, well, yeah, I've got to tell you, my office, we all work, our administrative offices are in a building called the hospital building, named because that's what it was. Most of the offices are on the second floor, but there's one office in the back on the first floor. And she said that was where she was working. Now, the interesting thing about early 19th century military architecture is there are no internal staircase in this building. The only way to get from the first floor to the second floor is an external stairway. So she said she was sitting down in the back office. The people upstairs said, oh, we're going out for lunch. Would you like to join us? She said, no. They leave for lunch. They lock upstairs. And a while later, she hears footsteps going up and down the hallway above, you know, above her office. So she figures, well, maybe they got takeout. They came back. And a little while after that, there's someone knocking on her door. And she opens it up and it's a visitor. It says, well, they wanted to pay admission, which you did upstairs. And she said, well, they're back. And the visitor said, no, there's no one there. The door is locked. So she was very firm that she had heard these footsteps. And we come back from lunch. We were in my office chatting, and we're alone in the building at that time. And those same footsteps go up and down the hallway as a, like, validating the story that I had heard an hour before.
That gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, I was like, wow, okay, so day one, here we go.
What have I signed up for?
You know what? I can count on one hand the number of times I've been afraid here. And most of those times it's been broad daylight and it was a human being, not a spirit thing. So I wasn't afraid, just acutely aware of it, I would say.
When you think about a spirit haunting a particular location, they're tied to it for some reason. And I would think with your title as executive director, you're trying to help rebuild the fort, that they would have respect for that and what you're doing.
I've also always tried to be respectful of the energy. Who knows what sufferings transpired here? You know, whether you're a believer, a disbeliever, a skeptic, or whatever, none of us on this side of the realm are anything other than believers, you know? And I'm not going to judge someone else's thought process. So I've just always tried to be very respectful of the spirits.
And when you think about the history there, for example, the Revolutionary Battle, hundreds were dead or wounded. Civil War, there was prisoners of war held there that had to have been in the Civil War. It wasn't pleasant, I think is an understatement.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you, for instance, today, the casemates are flooded. Like, the water situation is appalling. Water brings mosquitoes. There's dysentery. There's, you know, disease is rampant. There's not proper sanitation. There's death by firing squad. There's death by hanging. There's death from disease, yellow fever epidemic. And then those sort of fallow periods where we don't know what happened. So it's layers of history, layers of hauntings.
Now, have you done the paranormal tours, and we'll get into some specifics on things that have happened, but have you done those tours for a long time there? Is that something relatively new that you've kind of embraced the paranormal part of this fort?
There was already paranormal programming when I joined the team here. I think what really put the fort on the map was the discovery of Casemate 11, which we believe is the powder magazine that dates to the British construction. So this goes back to about 2006. Ghost hunters investigated. I can't really even speak to what was the first experience here, or what was the first sort of repeated experience that kind of got the fort on the paranormal world's map. I think over the years, the interest and accessibility of paranormal programming has increased dramatically with a lot of the cable shows and stuff, and with a number of historic sites opening up to this possibility as another sort of avenue of programming.
And I would also think, as the executive director, it's also another avenue of revenue.
Absolutely is.
Because you're trying
to... And the money looks the same as the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, right. And to me, you know, it's all going towards preservation and work that needs to be done. And so I think it's a great idea. Whenever I hear places kind of embracing this paranormal side of their history and what's happening there, I think it's brilliant, actually.
It's a circular logic, really, because if you are respectful of the history and respectful of the paranormal experience, you use the paranormal experience as another lens through which to view the documented history and another way to tell the story.
Yes.
And we have also found, by and large, the paranormal investigation groups that we've worked with are very respectful of the site. They have done some level of research in advance, and they're excited to be in the space and may even be willing to volunteer at some of our historic events. So it's a situation where everyone wins.
I love hearing that. I really do.
We really try to let people have their own organic experience. And we only share stories that we believe to be true. So we, first of all, want to have evidence of multiple people having the same or similar experience in the same location of the fort that kind of can't be explained any other way. And then we pass all of that through the lens of our documented history and ask, does it make sense? And consequently, if like 10 people said they saw a monster come out of the moat, we're not going to share that with anybody. But when five people experience a Revolutionary War soldier in the vicinity of the Powder magazine, that's really where we start to pay attention.
So let's get into some of those stories.
All right.
I'm very interested in these. And I jotted down a few that I read about, but maybe we could start with the Faceless Man.
The Faceless Man has been experienced in numerous locations throughout the fort. I can say that I tend not to see things, but I hear things. So my understanding of the Faceless Man is he's often a shadow figure. He's frequently encountered in the back of Casemate 5, sometimes in Casemate 11. And there are some people that believe he might be William Howe. William Howe's story is probably our most compelling specific paranormal haunting that we've been able to tie to documented history. Are you ready for that one?
I really want to hear about William Howe.
So William Howe was, he voluntarily enlisted in a Pennsylvania unit during the Civil War. He was a veteran of the Battle of Fredericksburg, and some newspaper accounts have him carrying his troop colors off the field of battle. He was not known to be a coward under any circumstances. After the Battle of Fredericksburg, he became critically ill with dysentery, and you've seen enough documentaries and stuff, you know, that Civil War field hospitals were, you know, overcrowded, filthy, dirty, almost as horrible as a battlefield. So he decides there's no way he's going to get better in a field hospital. So he returns home to Perkiomenville, Pennsylvania. The story of how he gets there is, I don't know how that happens if you're critically ill with dysentery, how you manage to get from Fredericksburg to Perkiomenville. But he is at home in the care of his wife. When 6 months later, the enrolling officers come to retrieve him to face court-martial for desertion, they come to this house around midnight one night. They're not in uniform, and shots are fired, and one of them is killed. Howe initially escapes but is captured, held at the fort. He's tried for now, not just desertion, but also murder. He is convicted, and they appeal because there were some procedural irregularities during the trial. He is convicted a second time and sentenced to hang. He attempts escape, is captured, and then sent to Eastern State Penitentiary, another site in Philadelphia with a long list of paranormal experiences, but returned to the fort to face his execution in August of 1864. It was the last public execution on the fort's grounds. So it is believed that he was held in solitary confinement in casemate 11 at some point during his imprisonment here. How do we know this? Because he signed his name on the wall.
Oh.
It's a great public history teachable moment because a lot of historic sites, you go to them and you say, this is what happened here. This is exactly what happened here. Nothing more, nothing less. But this is a case of learning more about history by continuing to be open to finding new information. So when Casemate 11 was excavated in 2006, there was a number of things. There were a number of things that were found on the walls there, including William Howe's signature. There's some writing on the door to his cell. There's the writing of another person down there, Bernard Devlin. There's always room to discover something new in your understanding of what might have happened in the past.
And talk about a tragic life. It makes me all emotional for poor William because what he saw in the war had to have been horrific. He's really, really sick. How he made it home, I have no idea. Then they come after him. He doesn't, you know, he's just defending his property. He doesn't know, you know, they could be anybody.
And one of the newspaper accounts even questions whether he actually fired the shot that killed one of the enrolling officers, or if perhaps it could have been Howe's wife. There are a number of kind of overarching questions. And tragically, his sentence was commuted a year after his death.
No.
Talk about a day late and a dollar short. Yes.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation about Fort Mifflin in Philadelphia with Beth Beattie, the executive director. For more information about Fort Mifflin, as well as the paranormal investigations and tours, go to fortmifflin.us. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts and you can try it 3 days free. You can also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. You can find everything there also, all ad free. For all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Carol Hughes. Thank you for listening.